The corporate accounting scandals of Enron, WorldCom, and other companies in summer 2002, as they were alluded to in the corporate-controlled media, resulted in some very quick legislation by Congress. In a culture that sees the world as a giant machine, however, the fix is likely to affect only symptoms and not the underlying cause of these and future corporate scandals. Due to, I suspect, one man's keen interest in justice for people around the world affected by the drive for corporate profits at any expense, we begin to understand a huge part of the underlying problem of corporate irresponsibility. Because of a mistaken interpretation of a Supreme Court reporter's notes in an 1886 railroad tax case, corporations are now legally considered persons, equal to humans, and entitled to many of the same protections once guaranteed only to humans by the Bill of Rights. This is not what the founders of the United States had in mind. The result of this corporate personhood is vast and is the subject of a book by Tom Hartman, international relief worker, psychotherapist, father, and author of over a dozen books, including Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance, and The Theft of Human Rights. You know, Tom, during this season, this is book season, there's one book I look for that, you know, I could be running 5-10 years from now and still going to have that impact. It's a heavyweight book, and I appreciate your being in the studio today.
Oh, thank you, Paul. It's an honor to be here.
Can you tell us about that first seed of inspiration that led to the writing of the book?
Well, I had written an earlier book called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight that was about the ecocide that's happening, you know, how ancient sunlight oil is being pumped up and thrown into our air supply, and we're just basically devastating our planet. And I was looking at the stories behind culture. You could think of culture as the collection of stories that we all agree to pretend are real and we're going to live by, right? And therefore, every culture is different based on their stories. And that our culture has these dysfunctional stories, like the story that we're separate from nature, we're something different from nature, that we can burn oil forever if we had an unlimited supply of it, and if we don't, we'll figure out something else. And you know, that there were these stories that were ultimately very destructive. And so I'd written this book about it. And afterwards, I just had this feeling like there was something I'd missed. And the more I dug into it, after that book was written, I wrote that book in 97, the more I got it that it wasn't just population that was driving the problem. It wasn't just our Cartesian worldview. That there was this entity called the corporate form, particularly the multinational corporate form, that had become... Well, it has a single value, and that single value is growth or profit. And I mean, that's how they're designed. And on its face, there's nothing wrong with that. A corporation's purpose is to make money. I mean, theoretically, in a society that cherishes free enterprise, which is a separate thing from capitalism, but that's a whole other discussion, that's a good thing. But when in biological systems, when one component of the system, which has a single primary value of growth only, takes over the entire system, which has other values like you and I do as human beings, the homeostatic needs, we need to breathe, drink fresh water, eat fresh food. When one part takes over the whole rest of it with a single value growth, that's called cancer in a biological system. And it just struck me that there was this cancer in our body politic and body economic, and which led me to wondering, how did it get this way? Which led to the research of discovering really the two bombshells in the book. One, that the Boston Tea Party was the first WTO protest. It was not against the British government. It was against a multinational corporation. And the second, that this 1886 decision that in law schools today, they teach lawyers. I mean, most of our legislators are lawyers, and they all learned in law school that the Supreme Court said corporations are persons. And it's a lie. The Supreme Court did not say that.
Yeah. One of the greatest quotes that William Grider used on this program, and I think it was from someone else, but he said that unadulterated growth, that's not the right word. It's about cancer. It's about unadulterated growth is the philosophy of the cancer. Or no, unfettered growth is the philosophy of the cancer cell.
That's right.
So that cancer metaphor is certainly used by other folks and recognized by other folks. You talk about the Boston Tea Party, its similarity to the WTO protests in Seattle that my daughter and I attended when she was a very, very young girl. And the Boston Tea Party we're taught in schools is all about taxation without representation, but you liken it to the WTO and to a protest against the East India Company.
Yes. Well, at its root, it was about taxation without representation, but what I had learned in school, in high school 30 years ago, or almost 40 years ago now, was that the Tax Act of 1773 raised the tax on tea. In fact, when you read the history, you read the Encyclopedia Britannica, the Tax Act eliminated the tax on tea for the world's largest multinational corporation and gave them a huge tax rebate on the tea that they had in inventory so that they could undercut the prices of the tens of thousands of small entrepreneurial tea sellers that were all up and down the East Coast of the United States. I mean, back in colonial times, having a tea shop was like Starbucks today and all the little coffee shops. I mean, they were absolutely ubiquitous, and everybody drank tea. It was like the drug of choice of the revolutionary generation, you know, along with alcohol. And so the corporation lobbied Parliament. They had essentially taken over Parliament by passing out stock in the corporation to members of Parliament in the House of Lords. They and the king was a stockholder in the corporation. And they got this law passed, this giant tax rebate, tax refund, and that was what was driving the rage of the colonists, was that, you know, I found a book, and doing the research on this, the participants in the Boston Tea Party swore a lifelong oath of absolute secrecy, of silence. And so most people don't realize that most people believe that there are no contemporary accounts of the Boston Tea Party. We know that Sam Adams was there because he kind of bragged about it. But other than him, nobody, you know, there are no names associated with it. Well, this one guy, George Robert Twelve Tree Hughes, had actually kept a diary of it. And in his old age, in his 90s, when he was living in Oswego, New York, he realized everybody else had died and felt that it was safe to publish this thing. And so in the early 1820s, this book was published called A Retrospective of the Little Band of Men Who Dumped the Tea in Boston Harbor by George R.T. Hughes. And I found a copy serendipitously in an antique bookstore, paid a good chunk of the advance I got to write this book to get it, you know, just because it was just shocking. It was, and as I read it, it was just this continuous rant about this multinational corporation that was putting out of business all the entrepreneurs, that had seized control of all the political apparatus of the colonies, that most of the, quote, elected or appointed officials, the governmental officials of the colonies, were also employees of the corporation. Many of the, quote, corporations that ran the colonies, you know, the Virginia Bay Colony, the Massachusetts Colony, and so on, which seemed to be independent sort of governmental corporations or groups or entities, were run out of the same home by the same person who was a director of the East India Company. And this was not unique in North America. I mean, they ran India for a century, the East India Company, and many, many other countries and islands and whatnot. It was the major force of empire of England. And so the Boston Tea Party was very much about throwing off a corporation, and the British were just the ones who were willing to offer the guns and soldiers to back up the corporation, and so we ended up, you know, at war with them.
A model that continues to this day.
Yes, it's called imperialism.
Yeah. Tom Hartman is our guest. He's an international relief worker, psychotherapist, father, and author of Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. I'm Paul Nelson. Yet the East India Company, perhaps the first or one of the first transnational corporations, did not have the benefit of being considered a person, which came after the Civil War. The railroads kept hammering that they had the rights of human beings, and finally the case, Santa Clara versus the Southern Pacific, for one reason or another, gave them that right. Tell us about that.
Well, we have to go back just a little bit with just a little tiny bit of history, and that is that when the framers put together the Constitution, and the framers were in many cases different from the founders, you know, so it's useful to make that distinction. But anyhow, when the framers put together the Constitution, largely at the insistence of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, they wanted to put an absolute wall, an absolute barrier between the possibility of government ever growing so large that it would oppress its citizens and the power of the citizens. So they wanted to hand this huge club to human beings that they could use to beat back government if it ever became oppressive. And that club was based on the writings of John Locke on the notion that humans are born with certain human rights. And the human rights hadn't been written into the Constitution. And so they wrote the Bill of Rights, which says, you know, we have the right to assemble. We have the right to free speech. We have the right to a religion, and the state can't interfere with that. We have the right to privacy. We have the right not to speak against ourselves. You know, all these very specific rights that were enumerated in the Bill of Rights. And then after the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments added to those rights in the course of freeing the slaves. Well, up until 1886, corporations didn't have access to that because they weren't persons. And because they weren't voters, most states had laws that said that if a representative of a corporation tried to talk to a politician about corporate business, it was a felony. They could go to jail. It was called undue influence, or it was called bribery. They couldn't give money to politicians. And so what happened in the 1886 Santa Clara case was right after the Civil War, when the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed freeing the slaves, the 14th Amendment says that no person shall be denied due process under the law or equal protection under the law. And historically, you and I, people like you and I, have been referred to at law. I mean, this goes back to like 15th century England, had been referred to as natural persons. And churches, corporations, and governments had been referred to as artificial persons. They had to have some sort of legal status so that they could pay taxes and show up in court and stuff, you know, representatives of them. But they were called artificial persons. Well, the amendment doesn't say natural person. It only says persons. Although the first sentence of it says, all persons born in the United States or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. And then it goes on to say, no person shall be denied equal protection of the law. It's obvious that they're talking about human beings. But the railroads started saying, this amendment says person. It doesn't say natural person. And we're being taxed at different rates in different counties. We've got communities all over the United States that are trying to fix the prices at which we can haul freight and passengers, because they were essentially monopolies in most of the country. I mean, they'd meet in the big cities, but other than that. And they
got huge grants of land.
Oh, it was mind-boggling. I mean, we're talking, you know, over 100 million acres of land and the equivalent of tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. They were like the computer industry. They went from nothing in 1830 to, by 1860, being the largest commercial enterprise that this continent had ever seen, and one of the largest in the world.
And you could call it government largesse, but the government didn't even own that land. It was the land of the people, the first people of the country.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, absolutely. Although a lot of it actually was taken from settlers who had received it from the government through the right of eminent domain. So it was a combination of all those things. But in any case, the railroads were coming in and saying to the Supreme Court, we're going to refuse to pay taxes, we're going to refuse to do this, we're going to refuse to do that, because we're being discriminated against. Because, you know, if one county can bill us one way and another county can bill us another way, that's illegal discrimination. Well, in this one particular case, the Santa Clara case, the main defense that the railroad used was that it was a tax case. For 6 years, they'd refused to pay their taxes to Santa Clara County, the Southern Pacific Railroad.
Not a lot of tax either.
No, we're talking, as I recall, it was a $30,000 tax on $30 million worth of land. So it's like buying a $100,000 house and refusing to pay $100 taxes on it. You know? So anyhow, they took this to the Supreme Court. The main argument that they made was that the county assessor had determined the value of the fence posts along the right-of-way for taxation purposes. They weren't saying that the value was wrong. In fact, they agreed with his assessment of how much the value should be. But they said that, according to the law, he didn't have the right to make the assessment. The state did, because the state had chartered the corporation, and for a few other reasons. That was their main argument. Then they had a couple of other kind of side arguments. And then they had this argument that said, and besides that, we shouldn't have to pay any of this stuff, because people don't have to pay taxes on mortgages. You know, you get these mortgage refund discounts on the taxes. It's tax deductible, your interest on your mortgage and things like that. And there was laws similar to that back then. And they said, we're being taxed in a way that's different from humans. And that's illegal discrimination under the 14th Amendment. Well, the Supreme Court, history tells us, I mean, lawyers, legislators, all believe that the Supreme Court said, yep, sure enough, they're right, corporations are persons, and that was the end of that. And all of a sudden, corporations had access to this huge club of the Bill of Rights, and they could and they could beat down literally tens of thousands of laws that have been passed across the United States that kept them out of the political process, that forced them to keep their books and processes open to government investigators, and on and on. I mean, we can talk about the abuses. It's just shocking. But so I had heard about this, and I had read about this in all these different people's books where they all said, yeah, in 1886, the Supreme Court gave corporations personhood. I wanted to read the case. So I live in Montpelier, Vermont, the capital of Vermont, and it's one of these, it's 9,000 people in this town. You know, it's the only capital city with no McDonald's, and it's great. I mean, you can walk into the governor's office, and he's sitting there going, hi, how are you? You know, and so I walked into the Supreme Court building, and there's the library, and there's the librarian, a guy named Paul Donovan, and I said, Paul, I want to find this case. And he goes, oh, come on along with me, you know, and go back through these dusty stacks, and he pulls out this old, I mean, the dust is like floating off it, right? Nobody's looked at this thing in 80 years. It was published in 1889, and it's the original U.S. reports. And he says, here's the case. And I read the case. I sat down, and it took a couple hours. I mean, it's a fairly long, dense legalese thing. I read the case, and the case says, yes, we, the Supreme Court, agree that the state assessor should have assessed the fence posts. End of discussion. And there's a little footnote in there that says, you know, five other defenses were made, including one that was on constitutional grounds, and the Supreme Court, and we, the court, decided not to rule on those things. And so I go to Paul and I said, Paul, this thing says corporations are not persons, you know, that the court didn't rule on that. And he said, well, look at the fine print at the front. Sometimes you'll learn something from that. It's called a headnote. It was a commentary written by the court reporter. And I look at that, and the first sentence of the headnote says, corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment entitled to equal protection under the law. And I said, Paul, the headnote is different from the ruling. And he said, well, the ruling is law. The headnote's just a commentary. But he said, but I'm not a lawyer. You need to talk to a lawyer. So I made a copy of this thing, walked down the street to Jim Ritvo's office, who's an old friend. He's a lawyer in town, and laid it out on his desk and said, Jim, first of all, what'd you learn in law school about the Santa Clara case? And he said, I learned that's when corporations became persons. He said, that's what we all learned in law school. And I said, well, here's the case. And I had highlighted the parts, you know, and I said, read it and then read the headnote. And, there's like 3 or 4 minutes of silence while he's reading this. And then he says, holy cow. Actually, it was a little more expletive than that, but this is radio.
Something that comes out of a cow, I'm
yeah,
guessing.
There you go. And I said, you know, what is this? And he said, it's a mistake. He said, it's just a mistake. He said, the headnote says that they're persons, but the ruling says that they're not. And I said, how can that be? And he said, you know, mistakes like this creep into the law all the time. It's why in law school you're taught never read the headnotes, read the case. And I said, but the Supreme Court has based rulings on these headnotes. And he said, well, you know, we have a problem. But he said, you need to talk to somebody who really knows constitutional law. He said, I'm just a criminal defense lawyer. So I called up, again, one of the wonders of living in a little state. I called up Deb Markowitz, is our Secretary of State. I looked her up in the phone book, called up. She answers the phone. Hi, this is Deb, the Secretary of State. Deb, you're a lawyer? Yep. I told her about the case, and she was equally amazed. And she said, well, you know, headnotes are not precedential. They do not create precedent. They are not the law. But once the court has ruled, referring to the headnotes, that subsequent ruling, and the first one that I can find was around 1897, then becomes the law. So it is the law, even though it's based on a lie and a mistake.
And you know, we never knew this till you dug it up.
That's right, yeah.
So it's your research.
Well, there was one Vanderbilt Law Review article about this in 1964, which I found after the fact, actually. So somebody else knows about this, but it's not common knowledge. You're right.